The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgearin.com/rain.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fighter pilots, we've got great swords. We'll shoot our watch anytime. You know, it's awesome. You get us started, and you can't stop us. But how to tell that story to the general public in a consistent fashion that makes sense and is concise enough for people to understand what the main point is? And so it took me years, and I finally boiled it down to one liner. I perform so we win. That's why. You work so hard as a Viper driver to be the best you can. You're going to go out and you're going to dogfight with your wingmen, and you're going to kick their ass. You know, and you're going to do that Iceman and Maverick thing of, oh, you know, you suck, buddy. You know, and that kind of thing. But you're really, it's I perform so that we win. It comes down to what the team is, who the team is, and how to be the best you can as an individual so that the organization you are supporting wins. And I think that story kind of goes across, whether you're a software developer, whether you're a machinist at a manufacturing company, any of that.
Tower Twin, pitches release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altura 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Viper check 2. Viper ready to QA. Viper RAM Carapulse at 354. Sir, yeah, lights on.
Next, picture
610, 13,000,
Viper 1 target.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for watching if you're over on YouTube. Had my good buddy BA on the podcast today. Had a lot of fun flying with him when I was Air Force F-16 demo pilot, and he is a member of the Air Force Heritage Flight Foundation. So flying the Warbirds, which to me is the best part of the Air Force demo, is when you get a rejoin with a Mustang, an F-86, a P-51, whatever it might be, and represent the past and present, all flying in one formation. So we talked about that today. We cover a lot of ground. He started off his career flying the B-52, eventually the F-15E, and then the A-10. He now has Firecorn, which if you've listened to the podcast, you've been curious about jalapeno popcorn, you now can get jalapeno popcorn delivered right to your door. And that's down below in the link. It's Firecorn. So it's BA's company. He's perfected his version of Firecorn, and I think you'll really enjoy that. So you got to check that out down below, and you don't have to ruin or pepper spray your entire household. You can just get it delivered right to your door. So enough on Firecorn, but I think you'll enjoy this episode. As always, make sure you're following over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and subscribing over on YouTube. Leaving a rating review over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify helps the show out. And then making sure you're following along here on YouTube also is a great way to show support for the show. And if you're interested in more content like There I Was stories, you can get this over on Apple Podcasts, or you can subscribe to Patreon. I got those links down below as well. With that being said, let's jump to the podcast with BA. BA, it's good to see you. Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Rain, great to see you. It's been too long.
I know. I think last time we were zipping around, I was in an F-16 and you were in a P-51. So we're going to talk about that.
Actually, I think one of the last times I was in your back seat.
That's right. You did. You did ride in the backseat
exactly.
During the demo profile.
Backseat in your demo. That was fucking painful.
Yeah, I don't know why you did that. Because you had already done that before, correct?
I freaking love it. And I think it's important for, I always thought it was important for the demo guys to kind of see us civilian guys challenging ourselves a little bit. But I haven't done it for a couple of years now, Rain. And they've even stopped asking. I guess when you cross over 60, it's time for the old fighter pilot to hang up the G-suit.
Dude, if you asked me to get in the backseat of the F-16 for the demo net right now, I'd be like, I think I'm good. I think I'll pass.
I freaking loved it. It was, I had a ball.
I imagine we probably pulled somewhere in the neighborhood of 9.6 or 9.7 G's out.
Yeah, it's always, it's the take, as you taught me, it's the takeoff, that first pull there. There's no G warm up. Yeah, and it's the dedication pass. That was the one I'm like, oh, here it is. Oh!
It just doesn't end. You just
keep, it doesn't end. It keeps going.
Yeah, the beauty of that block 50 of the GE motor, man. It just,
oh, it's, it just keeps awesome. On
churning.
Cool. Yeah,
we got to talk about that too, because there's some family ties to the old Mighty Viper. But for exactly. you, I mean, we got to peel back. Yeah, we got to peel back that onion. We got A10, F15E, B52, P51. I think again we're talking about the ties to the F16 with your father and some space. Yeah. And then people are going to like this part, firecorn. We've talked about jalapeno popcorn firecorn on the popcorn. Podcast before. I think you've perfected that shoulder. It. Now you're making it possible for people to get access to something that's only exclusive to the Fighter Pilot Bar.
Yeah, exactly. I find the interesting story was when firecorn has been through a couple iterations, and my latest iteration is direct to consumer process for sale by Amazon. In a prior generation, when we were going through stores and having mail order capacity, one of my best customers were people at the Pentagon, because the Pentagon had set down a rule that said no more cooking fire corn, and because of the byproducts, shall we call it. So right, all of a sudden, right. all these little sixes are retiring, and they're like going, I can still get fire corn. So I sent a bunch of fire corn to the Pentagon many years ago for retirement ceremonies and such.
We've talked about it, you know, many times on the podcast, and every time we bring it up, people reach out about it. Now fire corn is the chance for them to go out there and get it. But you talk about the byproducts. That's how you know you make good corn, is when you walk into a fighter squadron and it's like you've just been pepper sprayed.
Exactly. The lieutenants are doing good work.
Yeah.
And you have everyone's to cough coughing. And walk out.
Eyes are watering. Like, this is great. Oh, well, we'll get to fire corn a little bit, but I want to jump into, I mean, I think it'd be appropriate. I mean, our last flight together was you riding in the back seat, but usually I would find myself on your wing in the Mustang.
Yes. Yeah.
How long have you been flying the Mustang?
I got checked out on the Mustang in 2003. I've been flying Heritage Flight since 2005. I've got over 1,000 hours in the Mustang, which is a pretty special thing to me. And actually, I did that at a air show with Loco at the F-22, and I found that a capability of the F-22 I never quite understood before was that you can have that aircraft produce chocolate cakes that say, congratulations, BA, out of the wheel well. So we got to the debrief from the flight. I crossed over the 1,000 hours. I had told Loco that this was a big moment for me. And we got to the debrief and out came this chocolate cake. It's always one of my favorite little moments.
You know, with Loco, he was like Santa Claus. Anytime he came around, there was stuff and swag being thrown around. There's pictures of Jack running around wearing Raptor shirts and just like Santa Claus Loco hops out of the Raptor and he's got shirts, yeah. hats, coins. I guess yeah, chocolate cakes exactly. now too.
Yeah. So Loco's is awesome. So love keeping in touch with him.
You know, I ran into him in December when I was down in Hickam. It was a good little layover where I got to catch up with him a little bit. We got to go play golf next time. That's the thing I really need to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've been doing Heritage Flight since about 2005, flying the Mustang. So we can chat about that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no. So the Heritage Flight, how'd you get involved with that?
Well, a Heritage Flight started back in 1997, and there's a couple of different Genesis stories. So if you ask Ed Shipley, one story comes out. If you ask me, another story comes out. There's probably three others. The Heritage Flight was something that was kind of getting kicked around, and Ed Shipley was, in fact, the guy that really ran it through the halls of Air Combat Command. So the coordination element and all of that really rested on his shoulders. But the original team put together was kind of the stars of the whole Warbird world. So guys like Lee Lauterbach, Reg Erschler, Jimmy Beasley, Ed Shipley himself, Bill Anders, my dad, Frank Borman was in there as well, and a couple others to try to get that star power recognition to start the program. And so the first official Heritage flight, and at least the way I, the story and the Genesis story I tell, was at the Nellis Air Force Base 50th Anniversary Tattoo Air Show in 1997 with Frank Borman leading my dad, Bill Anders, on a Heritage flight, four-ship Heritage flight. So that program got started through that process. Eventually, Air Combat Command signed on to it as a long-term program. And it's gone through many generations and is now has the U.S. Air Force Heritage Flight Foundation, founded by Dan Friedkin, which is an awesome vehicle to keep the whole program alive and going and funded effectively. And so the program is in a really stable, really comfortable, good place. We spent many years wondering if the switch was going to get turned off the next year kind of thing. So we're pretty proud of where that program has gone and the fact that it's stuck around for this long.
To me, it's the best part of being a demo pilot is flying in Heritage flight. And for those who haven't been into an air show and seen a Heritage flight, you will have one of the single ship demo teams from Air Combat Command, the F-16, the A-10, the F-22, the F-35, do the 15-minute routine and then rejoin with a Mustang, an F-86, a P-47, an A-1, whatever it might be. And it could be multiples to go out there and fly the Heritage formation to pay homage to past and present, which is pretty cool and dynamic. We had Abbotsford, it was me, you in the Mustang, and then I think Steve came up in the F-86. You talk about and the F-35. Talk about a dynamic formation.
Yeah, that's right. That was a while ago. That was a fun year. Abbotsford is a great air show that I've attended every year for many years. It's literally right across the border from where I live, up in Vancouver, BC. I live in Bellingham, Washington, just south of the border. So that air show has been kind of my bread and butter for the air show industry for many years, and they do a very professional job. And the interesting thing was we had a gear issue that year, and I just remember Steve Hinton being there, and I get down on the ground, I land the airplane, no big deal, the gear come down, and I had an issue with the strut. And Steve Hinton looks at it, goes, "Oh, we'll have one up here tomorrow." So it's always good to be, in company with guys like Steve Hinton. And it was awesome. So we fixed the airplane, and I think that was actually the Sunday show. So I think I had to kind of do this isn't working exactly right, but got the airplane safe on the ground and had parts up there. And Steve stuck around; he changed it out with us. It was awesome. So good, that was a fun year.
A good segue would be between flying Air Force fighters and Air Force aircraft and flying the Mustang. Some of the challenges. Can you talk to me? What have been some of the greatest challenges flying the Mustang for someone like you coming with your background, who obviously has a lot of time flying fast jets and complicated jets in the military?
So when my dad retired from General Dynamics, he kind of got back into the warbird world under the tutelage of Frank Borman, actually. So it was an interesting time for our family. I was still flying F-15Es at Seymour Johnson, teaching at the FTU there, and Bill bought a Waco YMF-5 and then a Beaver on wheels and got into the tail dragger business. And so here I am, a Strike Eagle guy, having to learn how to fly tail draggers. And if you the OFP, the operational flight profile in the F-15E at the time was basically, you're a voting member in flying the airframe, as you're kind of, we are mechanically, the F-15 still was mechanically hooked up, but you're kind of a voting member in how to fly the airplane. And the airplane does the rudders for you. And actually you can confuse the airplane when you start using rudders like a normal pilot would on any, GA aircraft. So I bought a T-6, was my entry bird into the warbird world, kind of not the best place to start, but I did. And learning to fly the T-6 and remind my feet that rudders are important, and to remind my ass that, my feet control whether I'm actually in coordinated flight or not. That was probably the hardest thing. And so I had to relearn what the Dutch roll exercise was. And to this day, that is one of my bread and butter. The Dutch roll is where you're using the rudders to keep the airplane rolling around a point versus the nose going in that figure eight that would be caused by not using rudders. And it's still my bread and butter because, I fly a bunch of different Mustangs or different T6s, and every one of them is just a little bit different. So when I take off on climb out on an airplane I haven't flown for a bit, I want to check how the pitch sensitivity is, which is really kind of hard to do. But I can check rudder balance and aileron balance by doing a Dutch roll exercise. So if I'm flying an airplane, I haven't flown for a while, I'll do a Dutch roll exercise on climb out. And so it's really the use of the rudders has been the biggest thing. You know, I had a little bit of GA time before I flew in the Air Force, then got into the Air Force, and rudders are important. They're 37s and 38s and B-52s. But in the F-15E, it was actually, your plane was happier if you left your feet on the ground until you got into the high AOA dogfighting roll kind of thing. So that was probably the biggest challenge, was learning the tail dragger stuff. But it's learning to fly the Mustang was actually pretty easy. So I had about 300 hours in the T-6 when I went to Stallion 51 to fly the Mustang. And I had 1,000 hours in the F-15E. And if you take a T-6 and an F-15 and you mush them together, you get a P-51. It's remarkable how consistent the flight harmonics of the Mustang are comparable to the F-15. You know, here's 1940s technology comparing to 1970s technology, in the case of the Strike Eagle, 1980s technology. So that was actually, I got to Stallion 51, had the privilege of being trained by Lee Lauterbach, and I was checked out in 7.4 hours. It was the second shortest checkout time to date. And Bill, my dad, was checked out in 7.5 hours, and Lee was watching the clock, and he had to be able to call my dad and go, "I checked your son out faster than you." So standard fighter pilot competition, it goes on. So that was the heart of the learning curve for transitioning, you know, from Air Force fighter hardware into the Warbird fighter hardware.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I've just been this whole time trying to figure out what rudders are, so I'll have to go look that up once we get done with this conversation.
Yeah, go out and practice your Dutch roll exercise, and I'll, if you need, you know, videos, I could get the sticks out and we could talk about it later.
What is this? This is terrible. Have you had any moments in the Mustang that were like, this is not good? Any kind of oh shit moments in the Mustang?
Probably the most dramatic one was we were doing a fly day for our museum up at Bellingham Airport. You know, anytime you get a 75-year-old airplane over the mountains, there's definitely an oh shit factor right there. Yeah. You're listening to the motor, you're like, going, that doesn't sound exactly right. It's something. Oh, something's up. And it's amazing how those things clear up as soon as you get over a runway somewhere. Don't understand it. Probably the most dramatic tale and most entertaining with results, actually, came in on a two ship pitched out in the Mustang 360 overhead on a fly day at Bellingham. And I rack it into, and you do want to do a 360 overhead in the Mustang, because the hardest thing about flying the Mustang is slowing it down. So the 360 overhead pitch really helps scrape some of that speed off, so you can get yourself into that landing speed profile. So into the brake, it's a pretty aggressive brake. Always have to have a little bit of climb, because the Mustang just doesn't have that AOA that you do in the Viper or an Eagle. So you got to get some altitude as well. So hard into the brake, about halfway through the brake, and the cockpit fills with smoke. That's never good. I'm kind of like, holy shit. And I had about probably 200 hours in the Mustang at the time, so competent, but not super qualified. I'm never comfortable, so I will never say I'm comfortable in the Mustang. I always treat that girl as she is, never be comfortable in an airframe, in my opinion. So I go into the pitch out, and it's just, I get this acrid fire smoke, and it's clearly electrical, but there's also a different component to it. I can't tell quite what it is. Roll out and just broadcast on the radio, go Bellingham Tower, 151 Alpha Fox is emergency aircraft. I have a cockpit fire. I'm shutting off the radio, and I will land from the base position. Turn the power off, and the smoke comes out, and it's coming out from right by my right leg. And the fuel pump, which you run all the time in a Mustang because of the way the fuel's kind of below the engine, so you're always running the fuel boost pump, which is prior to the actual engine driven boost pump within the system. But you're always running that to make sure you don't ever cavitate fuel at all. So power comes off. As soon as power comes off, I crack the canopy, smoke clears right out, and I look down by my left leg, and there's this smoldering piece of canvas down there. And I didn't know the airplane really that well from a mechanical standpoint. So I was like, I don't know what that is exactly. So mostly I focus on the flying. I get the gear down, start a left-hand turn for the base. I bring the power back on just for a second to let them know I'm landing and the gear is down and hopefully get something from them. And they're like, oh, you want the fire trucks? I'm like, oh, yes, I want the fire trucks. And so as soon as I bring the power back on, it starts smoking again. What it was this canvas cover over these two resistors that are part of the resistance system to generate the proper fuel pressure on your fuel pump. And so those resistors, they just wear out sometime, and their failure mode is catch on fire. So as soon as I got the power off, everything, yeah, exactly. Good system. As soon as I got the power off, back off again, it stopped smoldering and stuff. And so I just had the canopy cracked open to get fresh air in. Landed the airplane. It was no big deal. The comedy of it was we had never had at that stage of the game as many people show up for that fly day. So somehow somebody was monitoring the airport frequency. By the time I land, the fire trucks are there. We shut down off the edge of the runway. We tow the airplane back in just to get all the fire systems off and not be on the radio. Handheld radios working, all that. Get it back to the museum. And that takes about 45 minutes. By the time we get back there, we have two media trucks, one radio media and the local television feeder company there to do interviews with us. So we earned media, man. It was awesome. Yeah.
That's great. Hey, no such thing as bad press.
Exactly. So it was definitely a heart stopper kind of thing where you're like, I'm really on fire. This is bad.
Yeah.
So I've been very fortunate. I've never lost a motor, knock on wood. And I use a thing called the Heinz filter in the P-51, and it's a filter that It's a aftermarket secondary filter system, and that filter system saved me on a sortie. I would have lost the motor on climb out on a sortie, but what it does is it has a chip detector. So if there's metal is in the oil, there's a little it's like a spark plug, but in reverse format. It's a little magnet on it, and if a piece of metal touches that, a light comes on. It says, "Hey, there's metal in your oil. Metal in your oil is a bad thing. That means your engine's doing something it ain't supposed to be doing." And then there's in addition to that, there's a second light that would come on as a bypass filter. So if your bypass filter starts to fill up with particles, it'll continue servicing oil to the motor, but it'll go through a different pipe and the bypass light will come on. So you kind of have two ways of indicating that your engine's having issues. So I was taxiing out, I was at Boeing Field and had a 06 from ACCA3 in the back seat. We were going to fly up to Fairchild to move from the Seafair show to the Fairchild show. And so taking off out of Boeing Field, it's basically right downtown southern Seattle. So there's not many options in terms of where you're going to put an airplane down if the motor decides to quit on you. And anyway, I get down to do the run-up area. Somewhere in that bypass light usually starts up when you start the motor because the oil's cold and it goes bypasses the filter because it's just too cold to go through it smoothly. So that light comes on when you start and you're like, oh, okay, system's working. You taxi out. Somewhere in there, that bypass light went off, but the chip light came on and I didn't notice that switch. And so when I get down there to do the run-up, I've got the light still on and I kind of like, oh, that bypass light shouldn't be on. And start to do the run up, and I get talking to the colonel in the back seat, and we're getting ready for takeoff. We're flying to Fairchild, you know, it's that standard. Okay, here I'm focused. Go, go, go!
Right.
And I do the run up, and then the bypass light comes on as well, and I'm like, "Well, that's bad." So it's kind of a big deal to, you know, this was Thursday, so I was going to, you know, the Thursday pre-deployment day to get there. So it wasn't like I had tomorrow to work on it. Kind of did, but we taxied back in, pulled the plug off of the Heinz filter, and it lets out that oil that's in that filter setup. It looked like there was gold glitter in it. Ooh. It was just all kinds of motor metal and that kind of stuff. So knock on wood, because of a safety system that we, in a post, an aftermarket system that we put on the Mustang,
I literally would have had an engine failure. I don't think that that engine would have, it lasted through me taking it off of 47 inches of manifold pressure, which is your initial climb manifold pressure. I would have been lucky, but I would have, you know, left Boeing Field, got out over East Seattle, maybe, and then over the Cascade Mountains. So I think about that, you know, that was kind of like, better be lucky than good, but in this case, actually, it was good planning that saved that airframe. So that's one of those, it's one of those sorties that spooks me still, but I never flew it, so that's awesome.
Yeah, right. It's the story of the report that will never be written, because fortunately the technology was there to be the piece that stopped the, you know, little, the air going through the Swiss cheese model, or, you know, the malfunction going through the Swiss cheese model.
Exactly. It's that same kind of safety. It's a system that, you know, kind of watches that golden chain and makes sure we connect one little piece. And, you know, we put that system in about 2007. This was about a 2009 air show timeframe. And I've talked about that particular system and advocated for it at both ICAS, International Council of Air Show Conference, as well as this NWOC, the National Warbird Operators Conference. So I've been proselytizing out there to talk about the Hind system, to talk about the various systems that do that same thing to the Warbird community. And I think a lot of people have added those kind of things, not just because of me, but as in part. And so it's impacts that we can have on the community. So,
well, I mean, I think every jet that I have flown, minus the T-38, and maybe that, I don't think it does, has it had a chip detector. T-6 had a chip detector, F-16 had a chip light, you know. Having that kind of technology, at least to give you a little, what's that?
I don't think the Strike Eagle did. I know the A-10.
Yeah. I mean, you got two motors. The A-10, I mean, for sure.
Yeah, we got two of them. Shoot, yeah, Doug, it's fine. You know, lose one, what? Who cares?
That's fine.
You know what the bolt face for Strike Eagle, if you lose a motor, is, right?
What is it?
There is no bolt face for the Strike Eagle.
That's what I figured. It's just like, whatever.
Other engine as required. You're like, yeah, whatever. I'm in the middle of takeoff.
You know. Yeah. Twos, I will give you, having two motors is kind of a nice thing, you know, but.
I'm mostly a single engine guy now. So yeah. You know, I was all multi-engine when I came out of military, but now I'm single engine mostly.
And arguably, you know, you're always thinking about the nearest piece of concrete and the one-to-one.
I actually code in my own head. I kind of do a ribbon of my flight path. And I color code my ribbon. I've taken off, when I'm first taking off, there's probably not many places for me to go except maybe a field. I'll code my ribbon yellow. If I'm over the mountains and there's no airfield I go to and I lost that motor right here and now I'm bailing out, I code my ribbon red. And when I'm flying along and I'm actually thinking about it, I'm like going, there's an airfield over there. That one will work. That field looks good. I'd leave my gear up. I'd put my plane down in that field. Then I'll code my ribbon yellow if it's a fields only. But if I've got a piece of concrete I can land on, my ribbon's green. So it's actually a mental visual that I keep up in my own cranium almost constantly.
Yeah. So you're not just willy nilly going about it. You have a plan. That's what.
Correct. Like. You got a plan. You're watching for. Again, that's the 80-year-old motor now is. We build new motors, so it's kind of a joke, but it's still designed from that time frame.
Right.
You trust it. It's a very reliable motor. The Packard built Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. It's a great machine, but you pay attention. So,
yeah, there's.
But I will tell you, the Mustang glides well. Lee Lauterbach's a big part of his teaching is to show you how that airplane glides. And he has a glider background as well, so he really understands that airframe in so many ways that are so far above my understanding of it. It's awesome to just be around him. But he has shown me how well it glides, and so I do have a very good mental picture of what it will be like when that motor quits and when that airplane becomes a glider.
Did you do engine out? Is that part of the training? Because I've heard, I mean, I think Lee has 15 or 16 hours of engine off time in the Mustang, which is
wild. Sworn to secrecy on some points, but so we'll skip that.
Yeah.
what Lee does in his initial training is, that blew me away as an Air Force guy. And this is, you'll appreciate this as well. Have you, in your FTU training for the Viper T-38, T-37, did you ever do an actual training abort on the runway, high speed abort on the runway?
No, I don't think I did.
Lee's program, you do. You take a P-51, and I think Kissimmee is a 7,500 foot runway. You go through the takeoff profile just like you're going to take off, and you get to 100 knots on the Mustang on a TF, and he says abort. And he'll guard the prop. And if you go through some mental gyrations and hesitate, you're not going to abort. But if you execute correctly, you're going to pull the throttle off. You're going to actually cut the mixture so the engine turns off. And it turns that prop into a giant speed brake because now the prop's being driven like a pinwheel. And so I did a high-speed abort in the Mustang, and we ate up probably 4,500 feet of runway. It was unreal. On 100, and the abort call was probably, I think it was 96 knots. We got to 102 before the power was back far enough to stop providing acceleration. So talking about fast and unbelievably, I couldn't believe that he would take that risk with his airframe, frankly.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess I'm thinking about it too, like never having experienced that or flown a Mustang, but the gyroscopic forces, I mean, the
exactly
what's going on with the rudders.
Gyroscopic forces, you got to put the tail back down. You're dealing with the tail dragger, so your center of gravity is behind your brakes. You've just taken your center of pressure, which is the airflow, and putting it up by the nose because now the prop's being pushed by the wind. You don't have your flaps down, so your center of pressure is really far forward, which is a big deal in the tail dragger world. And it was an impressive exercise. And I'm just like, Lee, I can't believe you do this, frankly.
Just phenomenal training. I mean, if people want to get Mustang training.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff you and I would have done in simulators, you know, and it's always the dial of disaster simulator, but he does it with his actual airframe. And it was a huge confidence builder for me. You know, at this time I had 5 hours in the Mustang. So, I mean, literally I've been in the backseat of ours, but ours has a stick back there, but it's definitely not a TF. It's good. You know, it's just I can simulate flying, but I don't have trim. I don't have any of that stuff. Okay. But I knew how the Air Mustang flew, and I'd been in the back seat with my dad quite a bit. But I had 5 hours of actually driving a Mustang flight time, and that's what we were doing. That's an instructor that really has large ones and really knows his craft. And so again, it's accolades for Lee. Any chance I get to chat with Lee or work with Lee, I love it.
Yeah, I was humbled. I got to fly with him at Sun and Fun in 2017. They brought him out of retirement. And this is the one where ACC approved one flight. It was like a practice in one flight. And we somehow managed to squeak out like 4 or 5 flights because, well, we need some practice. We got to do it over the field. You know,
of course. You got to get your currency back. You got to do this, you know, and then we got to get this. Oh, you know what? I didn't quite understand this portion. So let's do that again.
Yeah.
Been there. Was...
Hey. You're not cheating. You're not trying. We did. We had some good times. It's fun to watch Lee fly his single ship demo too. Because night he did the double roll.
That's something that I have never aspired to do. I'm a rolls only guy within my aerobatic competency card, my statement of aerobatic competency through ICAS. I just have never aspired to take my Mustang and point the nose at the ground at 2,500 feet. I'm just like, that's the other guys can do that. And there are amazing shows. You know, Lee's show is amazing. Yeah. Mark Peterson's show is amazing. Jimmy Beasley, Ed Shipley, those guys, they know that stuff like the back of their hand. Dan as well. I mean, that low level aerobatic environment is something that I'll leave that to others. I'm happy with
that. Yeah. There you go. That's all about it. Well, I would like to segue into really what got you into aviation in the first place? Where did the bug bite you? What got you into this field?
Interesting question. Family. You know, my dad was astronaut on Apollo 8. So he's, if your audience knows the Earthrise picture of the Earth coming up over the horizon of the moon, my dad took that picture. So, you know, I grew up sort of steeped in the Air Force environment. My dad came out of NASA about the time I was 6 years old, and we moved up to Virginia and kind of got away from general aviation, but there was always airplanes models around the house and stuff like that. I was six. I just always had a passion for it. Got up to upstate New York in high school and started taking flying lessons there, because so the bug had kind of bitten by that point. And it was just, you know, seeing the aviation, seeing my dad's Air Force buddies, astronaut buddies. So the bug kind of bit early, and me and my best friend from high school, a guy named Kirk Chambers, was taking flying lessons as well. And so he really helped me get through the 45-minute drive up to Syracuse to get to the flight school from Casanova, New York. So I got to Air Force Academy, intentionally going to the Air Force Academy, because at that point, if you wanted to be in pilot training, you got the slot. If you went through ROTC, you really had to compete for that slot. So I took the guaranteed yes up front, got into the Air Force Academy, and that drove me to, and that was, so the path was set there, and went to pilot training from there.
And then out of pilot training, B-52, is that the first, that's the first stop?
Yeah, so 8606 was my class time frame. This was kind of the post-Reagan years. We had more pilot training students than the Air Force needed pilots, sort of reverse of every other moment in Air Force history that I know of. So we had 60 people start in my class, and 19 of us graduated on time. I was the 20th graduate. Initially, I had that was the attrition rate. So, you know, you're looking around at your tables, just washing out left and right.
Yeah, perspective-wise, my class was 30. So for those listening, you can kind of.
Yeah, we had 60 in our class. It was two flights, so there was 30 in each flight. that's, you know, so, but there were 60 in the class. That's and huge. 19 graduated on time. I actually had an F-4 to the Air National Guard. Here's an academy guy going to the Air National Guard. That would have been an interesting assignment. But I ended up going to NIF for 3 months right at the formation check ride phase. I went in, I tried to fly when I was six, screwed up my check ride, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, I ended up sitting on the ramp for 3 months waiting for my next sortie. And based on all of that, I barely survived pilot training. You know, it was kind of the, well, here's another opportunity to wash one out. And so I barely survived. I went back into my flight commander, who was a Phantom guy. And he's like, dude, you had an F-4. So, but you're no longer FAR qualified. You can have any big airplane you want. And I said, well, I want the only fighter available to me. I want a B-52 or any special mission 130. He kind of went. He had never thought of a B-52 as a fighter, but I did, damn it. And so, so I ended up going to fly B-52s, and my first assignment was Anderson Air Force Base on Guam. And that's, being on Guam is kind of like going to Korea in the Viper. When you cut your teeth as a lieutenant in that combat environment, your fangs will always be sharper than the stateside guys, frankly. That's just, to me, that's a fact. I watched that through my whole career in the military. So the B-52 guys on Guam were a little more steeped in getting the job done versus flying the, you know, kind of the Curtis LeMay, fly the black line and deliver the package of sunshine. So I think that was a big help for me. And I got to the B-52, decided, you know, I'm going to be the best I can be, make the best of the opportunity presented to me. Flew it for 9 years, applied for a thing that was called SAC-TAC exchange back when we had SAC and TAC. We melded into Air Combat Command in, during my time frame, and B-52s and bombers were brought into Air Combat Command appropriately. And I was flying, I had started up a thing called the composite wing up at Mountain Home. So my wing commander was a Strike Eagle guy. I was a B-52 senior captain in the B-52 flying for him at the composite wing. We had the B-52, the F-15E, the F-15C, the first F-16, F-15 with the JTID system, so the first data link guys, CJ Vipers flying with the SEED guys, and a KC-135. We're kind of considered a second punch. So I managed to stand this up. It was one of my favorite assignments in the Air Force, you know, inventing something. Yeah. That was awesome. So when it came time for me to, when B-52s were transitioning, as was the plan all along, B-52s start, transition to B-1, 34th Bomb Squadron, then move to the B-1. A lot of the guys went into the B-1, and Wing Commander calls me, and he's like, hey, Greg, I wasn't BA yet. I wasn't Strike Eagle call sign guy yet. So, hey, Greg, come on in here. I'd like you to go to my bomber. Yes, sir. Very excited to go to the B1, continue the 34th Bomb Squadron, the composite wing. He goes, no. If you can be at Laughlin in 10 days, you can get your T-38 recall. Then you go to Columbus, you get your IFF accomplished at Columbus. And then you can get to, you have about a week off between Laughlin and Columbus. You got about 2 weeks off between Columbus and Luke. And you will be in the last B course to go through Luke. If you miss Luke, there's not another B course because it's all moving to Seymour Johnson for a year. The only problem with that week-long timeline is that 10 days prior to this conversation, my first child was born.
Naturally.
I'm like, hey, honey, good news.
I'm super excited.
You're going to love this. I got the fire that I've always wanted, but I'm leaving tomorrow, and you've got the kid. Yeah.
Goodbye.
She's awesome. She's like, oh, get on the road. And so she stays actually in Merced, California. We were geographically separated unit flying out of Castle Air Force Base. So she stayed in lovely Merced, California, while I went to Laughlin and then to Columbus, and then we moved to Phoenix.
That's awesome.
So that was my transition into the fighters.
Well, in the composite wing, I honestly can't even keep up with it. You know, now that I'm getting a few layers removed. And I think the Air Force just announced these other big changes with reworking the MAJ comms, eliminating a bunch of stuff. So I don't know, maybe it's kind of going back to a composite wing again.
The composite wing is a great concept, but at the strategic level, it competed with carriers, one. And it was expensive because you had multiple motors. So you had multiple motor maintenance chains within a single base. So the maintenance chain was just more expensive. So if you're trying to cut costs, the composite wing comes to you at a premium. So it was a cost issue as well as a philosophical issue, in my opinion. So I think the composite wing is a great thing. I think it's worth every penny. I've never learned, you know, we go to Red Flag, and this is where you get to meld with your other airframe brethren and learn from them. We were doing that all the time at Mountain Home. We learned a lot. And we changed tactics. We rewrote 3-1 tactics based on, you know, how to best escort a B-52 with a Strike Eagle into a high threat environment. You know, at first you were driving all the fighters in first, and we realized that wasn't a good idea. You know, with F-pole and A-pole, you've got a capacity to run those B-52s in low level first, and they get to the scene first, and everybody's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And then the fighters show up. So we learned a lot. We did a lot of different stuff, and it was really a lot of cutting edge fun tactics. Things that we would do out, you know, we're in theater now a lot more than we used to be. You know, during my time frame, we weren't in theater nearly as much. And we were doing Southern Watch and Northern Watch, but we weren't doing like what you grew up in, which was, you know, you were constantly doing these composite type strikes because you were deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever. So, right. But in my day, we were far more stovepiped within airframes.
I'll say that's, you know, again, I've been removed from it. There was a period as I was leaving there, especially like on the East Coast, where you could go out and we would do once a month with Seymour Johnson, Langley. Sometimes you bring some guys from Beaufort, maybe guys up from Jacksonville and out over the water, you'd have fights, but it was all predicated to you had to have tankers because where we were fighting, other than the Strike Eagles, who I think can stay airborne for 2 or 3 days, everyone else had to get gas, you know, but it's good to do those interventions.
Strike Eagles stay airborne for 2 or 3 days, and that's only with about 10 minutes of afterburner applications.
So. Yeah. That's what, hearing those guys check in with their loadout and like in their play time, you're like, all right, I get it. You got a lot of bombs and gas.
I love that airframe. Viper's a great airframe, not to disparage the Viper, but I absolutely loved the Strike Eagle. Night low level at 500 feet, 540 knots, whizzle in the back seat, running a patch map for your strike that you're just about to do. I'm up in the front seat running air-to-air radar. It's your King Kong, and I love that airframe. That was my favorite airframe to employ.
Okay, yeah, I would say to employ, because obviously you rode in the Viper, so we know that was your favorite airframe, but I digress.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Of course, naturally.
So
questions? I have none. How'd you end up in the A-10?
What's that?
How'd you end up in the A-10? So you go from the Strike Eagle to the A-10.
I was 15 years active duty. Fighter Porch wanted to send me to Saudi Arabia to teach the Saudis how to fly the F-15S. I didn't enjoy that concept. I asked if they would give me a follow-on, a guaranteed follow-on to Lake and Heath. I was really trying to get to Lake and Heath. One, fly the 229 motors, and two, just be the tip of the spear. And three, my wife's mother is from England, so we have family in England. I was trying to get to Lake and Heath. And they said no guaranteed follow-on. So I'm like, well, I go to Saudi Arabia and I come back. And this was in a time frame when UAVs were just getting introduced. And so a lot of fighter guys were going to UAVs. And so that was kind of the major threat. And so they wouldn't give me the follow-on out of Saudi Arabia. I offered to do it. And I had a buddy up in Boise flying A-10s up there. And he's like, going, dude, come visit. We'd hire you in a heartbeat. And so while I say I enjoy, in a general perspective, I enjoyed employing the F-15E the most, in a specific perspective, I enjoyed employing the A-10 gun the most by far. So it was, so I had a chance to go fly A-10s. There is a special airplane. I mean, you don't get to fly that unless you're the pilot, period. You know, there's no two-seat A-10. So there were so many layers of how awesome that would be. And so I took advantage of that moment, moved over to the Air National Guard up at Boise, and flew the A-10 for 5 years, basically, and went to combat in that aircraft. I did Southern Watch and Northern Watch in the Strike Eagle. So I had combat time, but, it was all babysitting during quiet periods, making sure the rules were followed by Saddam Hussein. So the A-10, I got over the A-10 into the Guard, and finally got to be baptized in that fighter, in that combat environment. You know, not all fighter pilots go through their careers have an opportunity to fly in combat. And that's not, it's more luck of the draw than anything else, frankly. Just lots of, you're just like during 1991, I was sitting nuclear alert night one for during Desert Storm, you know, so that was my job. Sit nuclear alert. That's what I did. We had orders to be deployed, but then the war ended and we didn't end up deploying my crew. So it's a lot of happenstance. And as you know, you don't want to finish a military career having only supported the peacetime operations, but not everybody.
Tough spot. But again, like you alluded to, it's right place, right time. I can tell you stories of buddies who they're showing up after the cutoff had already been made for the spin up. Then they either stay behind as everyone deploys, then everyone comes back. Wrong place, wrong time. If you want to deploy,
leave Mountain Home, moving to Seymour Johnson. We're in the middle of the move. This Mountain Home deployed out to another Southern Watch. I'm like, oh, thank God I'm not doing that. Yeah. Sit there, babysit. And they kick off what was known as Desert Fox, a full on drop and hate thing. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. it's right place, right time. And from the Strike Eagle perspective, I had just left the squadron that then got to many of us christened themselves in that combat environment.
How was going from the Strike Eagle to the A-10 from a fighter pilot's perspective?
Comical.
Any challenges with it, or is it fun?
I've got some funny stories to it, if you want to hear a funny story.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't?
So I did my A-10 training somewhat oddly at Barksdale Air Force Base with the Reserve Squadron there.
Right.
So, tell about that. As opposed to being down at Luke with all the other A-10 training squadrons. So I go up to Barksdale, and these are all the Reserve A-10 pilots. These guys know their shit. They are so experienced. It's awesome. Right. So I'm learning from them. It was awesome. And me and another guy are in the class, call sign Torch Kramer, just the two of us in the class. And so there was some negative transfer that I was a little slow to pick up on. In the Strike Eagle, you disconnected the autopilot with the paddle switch. In the A-10, you disconnect all the casts with the paddle switch. So we take off one day, we're going up to a SAT range and the Razorback ranges. And I'm going to do our first SAT sortie where we're going to be shooting the gun. And we go up there, we've been doing the local range, shooting the gun on a surface attack type training, but this was a full SAT mission. So we go up there, we plan this 60-degree HADIB, high-altitude dive bomb plan. So we're rolling in 60 degrees, nose.
Are you a passionate aviation enthusiast? Then you'll be thrilled to hear about our sponsor, Aircore Aviation. This exciting company has been revolutionizing the aviation industry since 2008, and they have some amazing career opportunities available. More about that in just a minute. Aircore Aviation is at the forefront of airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating all the way back to World War II. Their dedicated team is involved in various aspects of aerospace, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, using state-of-the-art technology. Their exceptional expertise in core manufacturing capabilities like metal forming, CNC machining, and complete aircraft rebuilding has led to the restoration of some award-winning aircraft, such as a couple P-51s, such as P-51 Thunderbird, Twilight Tier, and Sierra Sioux 2. And if you've been following me for a while, you might remember I was fortunate enough to fly over the Super Bowl in 2018 in Minneapolis. The formation was led by Sierra Sioux 2 alongside two A-10s and myself in the F-16, so this is a very cool full circle experience. These incredible achievements have captured the attention of aircraft owners, aviation enthusiasts, and the general public alike. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation, then Aircore Aviation is the perfect place for you. They are rapidly expanding their team in 2024 and have job openings in departments such as engineering and CAD, quality assurance, fabrication, and restoration. This is your chance to turn a passion into profession. Aircore Aviation is offering some amazing benefits for full-time positions, including health insurance, PTO, HSA, retirement plans, life insurance, and the extra perk of enjoying Fridays off. If you're ready to be part of a team dedicated to fulfilling the dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircoreaviation.com/careers today and take the first step towards an exciting career in aviation. Again, that's aircoreaviation.com/careers. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Slow in the A-10. And as I get to the range, I hit the paddle switch to turn the autopilot off. And I punch off because the autopilot just turned off, I punch off the master caution light. I flew that whole sortie with a cast off, didn't figure it out till I tried to turn the autopilot back on afterwards. So the biggest thing the cast does is it stabilizes your airframe as you're shooting. And so I'm actually getting pretty decent scores, but there... We go through the initial debrief, and I'm like, yeah, and then when I'm recovering, this happened. And they're like, your CASs were off? We back up a little bit, and we realize the CASs were off for the full time I was employing the gun. So I'm sitting here trying to shoot in this the quote-unquote airframe manual mode, and it's working fine, you know, until it's too dumb and inexperienced and ignorant to understand what I'd done.
Because the A-10, it locks out, right? As you squeeze the trigger, it locks out. So you're just riding the wire down, whatever.
It kind of stabilizes the airframe and holds it there. So I'm having to fight all that, you know, and it's not happy because, you know, you're not spitting stuff out the nose. And the other thing I did was on one of the passes, you know, I roll in 60-degree HADIB, I pull off, I do my safe escape maneuver, nose comes up, I'm chaffing, I'm flaring, I'm thinking I'm a badass, I'm jinking and jiving, and I cross my... cross check goes through my HUD and I see like 70 knots. I'm like, oh, push in the afterburners. I don't have afterburners.
Oh gosh.
I full on falling leaf, roll over on my back, full on slow airspeed recovery. And I pretend that that's part of my jink. So that was great. So when you ask about the transition from Strike Eagle to A-10, that was probably the most entertaining moment where, again, fangs go through the floor. You know, you go to your habit patterns. I'd already screwed up one negative learning element already, and it was just freaking hysterical. So
70 knots is hysterical today. I don't know. not when you see it in the HUD.
Exactly. It was when you see it in your HUD and your nose is still 45 degrees nose high.
Yeah, this is not where I want to be in life. Come on, turbo fans.
Exactly.
You can do this.
The extra turbo fan switch and, you know, get that little extra bit of boost of energy out of it.
Well, that, I want to shoot the 810 gun. I can see the allure to that. I can appreciate how awesome that would be without having done it.
Well, in a career flying that, just, you know, unless you're going out for a true basic air-to-air BFM sortie, you'll go out and shoot 200 rounds on every training sortie. That was a brilliant part of it. 1,200 rounds. I emptied that gun 12 times in Iraq using it effectively. I employed it probably about another 8 of the 27 missions that we were on. We were doing a lot of cap kind of stuff where you're just hanging out, keypad casts. And so you're just kind of hanging out waiting for Army or Marines to call you into an engagement. And so a lot of times we would land, especially I was operating out of Talil for a little while. So outside of Anne-Nazaria, it kind of felt like the old P-47 days in France kind of thing. It was really interesting to be on contested soil as an Air Force guy flying out of Talil with the Army, which is, you know, kind of their standard MO, not a standard MO for the Air Force guys. And so it was really interesting. We could only fly out a day because we kept the lights off at night because, you know, we didn't want airfield attacks. There were many times that I would land completely unexpended just because we were doing the keystroke cap and nobody needed us.
What time frame was this in the war? Because this is 2003 opening days Iraqi freedom.
Yeah, probably end of March kind of thing, time frame in March, early April, yeah. If I have the dates right in my head.
And again, it was relatively calm in that time period, right? It was obviously the initial kickoff.
We sat at Talil and found out later that we were sitting at Talil, which is right outside of Anne-Nazaria, during the Battle of Anne-Nazaria. Other than that, it was really calm.
Oh, gosh, yeah. It's like, the timeline of Iraq, you know, I need someone to paint it for me because it was bad, and then it was somewhat less bad, and then, you know, the hornet's nest was kicked and Humpty Dumpty fell apart and not putting it back together again, and insurgency really kicked off.
The most interesting thing that I learned by being there is that war can be a fairly isolated thing from the population.
Interesting.
And if you watch, you know, most, you know, Saving Private Ryan and that kind of stuff, those kind of movies, they focus on those conflict points. But it's come to understand, and if you open your eyes to it and start looking for it, you understand that most of the, you know, it's not like every battle, the battle is just this one field, even the Civil War. The rest of the area, you know, people are pulling up to watch the battles in the Civil War and picnic and carts to have picnics and watch it. So war tends to be a very localized element of what's going on in a geographical region. So we were there at Talil, and my combat pair, Kurt Kingsley, Kingman, finds out that the ziggurat at Ur is within driving distance. The ziggurat at Ur is like page 2 of the Bible. So okay. These are kind of, you know, pretty interesting stuff. So we hop in a Humvee. We've all got flak vests on. We got our Kevlar helmets on, 9mm on our side. And, you know, we check to make sure it's relatively safe and secure. The FIBA had pushed well beyond Nazaria at this point. So we drive the 15 minutes up to the ziggurat at Ur, and we walk in our Kevlar helmet and flak vest and 9mm on our side. We were walking through Abraham's house.
Wow.
So there's the ruins of Abraham's house, which is more of a village than a house, but it's Abraham's house. And we're looking at the ziggurat at Ur, and this Iraqi guy comes up out of the little village that's right there. And we're all kind of looking at him going, well, this could be interesting. He walks up, he goes, hello, English? And we're like, yes. And he walks up and he goes, my name is such and such. It means friend. I am your friend. I'm going to tell you. And he was our tour guide for the ziggurat at Ur. His mother had been a part of the excavation of King Tutankhamun's tomb back in the 1920s. So he has all this background. He knows how to speak in terms of that archaeological significance. So he told us all about the ziggurat at Ur. He told us how it was used as a moon temple And it, when the moon would line up, it would cast through this thing on the top of the ziggurat, which looks like a pyramid. And the actual most important part was the altar that was down on the ground at the base, because the moon would pass through the top of the pyramid. It was fascinating. So it taught me that combat can be geographically a very localized experience. So I just finished watching, what's the new one on Apple?
I'm blanking on it. I know what you're talking about. Masters of Air?
Masters of the Air. So if you watch that, you start to see that, you know, they go on trips to places. You know, here's England that's being bombed, and they go to trips on places where the war just isn't geographically. I mean, that's England over on a different island, but it was kind of the same in France. You know, when you see the pieces where somebody bails out and they meet up with the local people kind of thing, you understand that, you know, the war, yeah, it is kind of all around you, but there's also a lot of geographical territory that the war does not even impact at that moment, other than, you know, it kind of puts a lot of limitations on the whole environment. But so yeah. I learned that war can be localized a lot more than you and I would anticipate. You and I are focused on the FIBA. We're focused on the combat zones. We're focused on the engagement. We're troops in contact kind of focus. So to us, war is everywhere that we want to look. A lot of stuff just isn't happening.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I never really thought of it in those terms. Obviously, you know, it can impact civilians and those things. But when you're, most people are milling about their normal day as best they can.
Correct.
Impact.
It was an interesting lesson for me as a military guy that really focused and studied Clausewitz, you know, Napoleon and all these things. And you realize, I've always been focused on that very minor element of geography that is the conflict.
Well, look, I'm glad you guys got out there and explored, you know, I mean, the MWR wasn't going to set that up. But wow.
You always said that if Iraq can get stabilized, there's some amazing, literally biblical level, tourism that could occur. So
we would try and find stuff with the sniper pod trucking back and forth. I think ISIS, unfortunately, destroyed a lot of anything that had any biblical significance.
Probably you had the same, the no bomb list of the Tower of Babel, the Garden of Eden. I mean, and you're like, wait, these are real places?
Yeah. They're all here. They're right here. This is weird.
It was pretty cool.
Ah, interesting. Your time leading up to, I guess, the rest of your time in A-10, you did have a couple medical issues. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, one, I broke my arm for a bit, so that's a kind of a different story. So I had just gotten requalified when we went to Iraq. So I was a very junior wingman still in the A-10, even after I'd been there for a couple years. Probably the one that's most important to us as the fighter pilot community was at the age of 46, I had been tracking my PSA, prostate-specific antigen, for many years. And because I was tracking that, I saw a significant spike in my PSA, which led me down a path of diagnosing prostate cancer. And if I had not been tracking PSA, I would have died at 47. I'm 60 years old now. So I'm yippee for extra years. I unfortunately had the very aggressive form of prostate cancer. There's kind of grossly oversimplified. There's kind of two forms of prostate cancer. One is the nodule that we all love to have the doctors look for. And the other is a form that more takes over the prostate gland in a less obtrusive way, in less definable way. And that tends to be the more aggressive form. And that was the form I had. So I would have never discovered if I had just gone to the finger check. I would have discovered it long after it killed me, basically. So, you know, whether I was actually dead when I found out it had killed me already was probably the same thing. So I was very fortunate to have discovered it. So we did the surgery was the clear choice at the time. We did the prostatectomy, reasonably successful. My surgeon basically said, you know, Greg, surgery was successful, but I had to scrape at the edges a little more than I liked. And so I kept an eyeball on things, kept follow up with what's called residual PSA. And 5 years later, it started to come back. And because it was that very aggressive form, we took a very aggressive stance, and I went into an 8-row radiation program. So round two with the prostate, it was round one that really kind of pushed me away from current flying of the A-10. I took a break, went into reserve, similar to what you did towards the end, where you were in that 3E position where you're points only.
Yeah.
And I got to 23 years, and I decided that was just time for me to move on, focus on the museum, focus on my life, focus on getting my health back. So did the radiation for several years, and that was very effective until about 5 months ago. So I've gone from being a cancer survivor to back to being a bit of a cancer patient. I hate being a cancer patient. I hate when people walk up to you and go, "Oh, how are you feeling?" You just hate that. I'd rather have my bros just go, "Hey, bud, how you doing?"
Yeah.
I'm doing some follow-on stuff. I would categorize it as more of a walking cancer, kind of like a walking pneumonia. But I'm fighting it again. And so what I've learned from that is, or what I've learned since the very beginning, is that there has been an increase of cancer incidence by about 15%, even though I think the data is still well under measurement for fighter pilots. Now, I spent 5 years sitting on an APG-70, just 6 feet back from the dang thing. And that APG-70 is and was the most powerful single dish air-to-air radar that we ever put on a fighter. You know, APG-68 is a great machine, great, it just doesn't quite have that strength. Lucky for you. So, you know, here's this piece of equipment that basically says, do not turn on the ground, you know, and we sat right behind it. So I think that there could be a link, and Red River Valley Fighter Pilots Association is starting to track that. I'm getting engaged with them and try to understand their position on it. Especially now that I'm kind of back in the pool of being cancer patient versus cancer survivor. It's very low key for me, but it's an early detection. So we're just doing some minor things to keep it tamped down. Basically, the embers started burning again. So we kind of threw a fire blanket on it. And so we're dealing with that. But I encourage, and I've talked to you about it. I've talked to all my fighter pilot buddies, especially guys that are running air-to-air radars. I think ACEs are better, but they're still lots of radiation.
Yeah.
And they're more sensitive. That's really the main thing for them. Their Raptor, that thing could be, I don't really know what the local emissions levels are, but I've been pushing my fighter pilot buddies to track PSA and to watch for those things. Because I think in my case, I primarily think I just got dealt an unlucky card. Sucks being me. I've done follow on the genetic testing. I do not have the Brachia gene, which indicates that, you know, you have a tendency towards this stuff. So I do think that the APG-70 was a contributory factor to me ending up with prostate cancer.
You tracking your PSA levels, did you do that on your own outside of the Air Force PHA, the physical you get every year?
My wife is part of a group of college friends. They all met the first year of their college year, 81-8, they call themselves. And so they're like a little family. They still get together. It's freaking awesome. So we were going to one of the 81-8 weddings back in the day. And so I'm meeting the guys. They're all on the East Coast. I'm West Coast guy or wherever. So we go to this wedding, we're standing around and we're talking. I'm like, "Hey, Brian, what do you do for a living?" He goes, "Oh, well, I'm in the medical industry. I sell medical devices to hospitals and stuff." I go, "Oh, well, what are you selling?" "I'm selling the Da Vinci machine." I'm like, "Oh, I read about the Da Vinci machine through DARPA. It was that robotic surgery system developed by DARPA for remote downrange surgery from a surgeon back in the States. So there's this little robot that they could control kind of thing. It never really panned out from that perspective just because of the data link time delay, but it became the ubiquitous thing for prostate ectomies, for hysterectomies, and for other surgeries kind of like that. He goes, "Well, I sell." So Brian, we're standing around by this pond, pine trees overhead, you know, kind of standard East Coast, nice feel. And he's like, "Well, I sell these things." And he looks at all of us and he goes, I want all of you to not be my customer. I'm like, what? He goes, well, it's a surgery machine for prostate cancer. So I want all of you to start tracking your PSA. And this was when I was about 37, 38. So I started tracking my PSA, and the doctor's like, I'm not going to waste my time on that test. I'm like, dude, it's a $12 blood test. Freaking do it. So I had to actually fight to track my PSA. There's been a lot of debate about false positives, all that shit. Not completely invalid, but not worth, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Right. And so I aggressively had to push to track my PSA. And frankly, if I had not been tracking my PSA, I think I would have been killed by prostate cancer at the age of 48. I would have found it at the age of 47, would have had an absolutely miserable year in aggressive battles with it and been dead by 48. So, like I said, I've got good 12 years of excess years under my belt right now, and I'm enjoying every one of them, dang it. Carpe diem.
There you go. One last question along those lines, because obviously throughout there's bouts of doing radiation. When you talk about flying in medicals, was there any significant hurdles to maintaining a medical certificate and keeping going?
I had to do a special issuance. And so, you know, back in the surgery, there was a special issuance. So I was grounded for months, got my special issuance and got it cleared, did the radiation, same kind of thing. I couldn't fly until I got the special issuance. FAA is far smarter and far better at handling these kind of things for guys like myself that experienced the cancers. They're smarter about, one, getting the special issuances out as quickly and painlessly as possible on a much clearer understood logic path, and they're just better at getting it done. And back then it was like, oh my god, you've got prostate cancer, you can't possibly fly an airplane.
Yeah,
now they're like, that may not have been completely correct, and we're going to get you back to flying status. No big deal. So my therapies I'm doing right now are hormone therapy, which is androgen deprivation therapy. They don't care. They're like, yeah, that's, keep us apprised of what you're doing, but you're good to go.
Okay. Well, that's good to
know. So FAA is, it all boils down to finding a good AME who's really willing to counsel you versus ratting you out. So I've got a great AME.
Yeah.
He takes aeromedical evaluator. So he does a great job of taking care of me and keeping, he's like, my job is to keep you flying. So let's open the conversation.
That's the ones you want. That's what my AME, I mean, it has that mentality. It's like, keep you in the cockpit, keep you flying. You would hope that's most of them, but yeah, I'm sure there's, we had a flight doc running around the base one time who was like, oh, there's a sniffle, you're to niff. Hopefully she doesn't become an AME one day. That's not the person you want to be an AME.
Well, I think Susan Northrup is our FAA top level AME. She's been to NWOC. She went to ICAS. She is extremely engaged. And I think that level of engagement is freaking awesome. And it's percolating down through the AMEs. And I think we as pilot, I'm only doing a class two physical, so I don't know if this would impact a class one physical. All I'm doing is a class two physical. So it's a little easier for me because, you know, all I'm doing is the air show stuff, flying the Mustangs, that kind of, I'm not doing an airline job. So be careful taking my words and falsely attributing them to a class one. I don't know what the levels of class, I think they're better across the board, period. But I'm not sure if class one is an easy answer here.
Well, it's one of those things too. Obviously, you're going to talk to your AME if someone's dealing with this, but it's good to hear these type stories because unfortunately at some point, people are going to have to go through medical issues with FAA. When I fly with guys who have had heart issues and stuff, I mean, if they're open to talk about it, I ask the questions because again, you never know. It might be you, it might be your buddy that's impacted by it. And so to have someone else who's kind of walked the path and dealt with it, it's kind of nice to know that, you know, you can navigate these hurdles. It's not just a auto ender for the most part. So appreciate you sharing that. Go ahead.
One other point on that is I am very pleased with the relationship between FAA and us as pilots and operators. I watched it on the air show side. It's become far more mutually professional respect back and forth between each other. There used to always be a bit of a combative element to it, and I'm talking pre-2003, even before I really got in. But that took a while to work its way out, and I think we have a very good. We're much more effective as an aviation industry by communicating effectively, and I'm very pleased with how this whole relationship has grown.
You know, again, I only have a very limited snapshot. My most of my interaction with FAA was during the air show, so interacting with the IICs. But for me, you know, it's kind of like you got your thing, do your thing. I do remember only one time they raked, it was old tuna. They raked tuna over the coals for some logbook. You know, it's like this guy was just, he was just being a jerk. But
yeah,
again,
yeah, you could, yeah. There's the II inspector in charge at an air show. That'll commonly be somebody with less experience. And I try to help train when they show up with the new guys. But you build a reputation, but you always have that chance of having somebody that's trying to prove something to their boss. I think the incidence of those kind of things has gone way, way down. And yeah, so that's why I say the relationship is better.
Yeah. One out of like 50 some odd air shows I did, there's just one guy. It was my second air show. So. I would like to ask a couple questions about your father, because I think that's pretty unique. As you already alluded to, he flew out into outer space, which is wild. Did you ever talk about that and his experiences? What were some of his thoughts?
We used to talk about that when I was younger, in my teenage years and stuff like that. He would tell us the stories and we'd ask the stories. We were very open to talking about it then. He kind of got burned out on that after a while. You know, same story over and over again. So he did less. By the time I sort of became his crew chief for the Heritage Flight. That's really how I started in the Heritage Flight. I was crew chief to Bill Anders. So I'd sit in the back seat, I'd prep the airplane for him, I'd strap him in and make sure he was ready to go for a Heritage Flight. So I was on the Heritage Flight circuit since 2003 and got on the team in 2005. On the team at the same time was Frank Borman. And so the two of them were part of Apollo 8. So Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders were Apollo 8. December of 1968, I was 6 years old. I have these vague memories of the actual mission, but they're kind of like, you know, your childhood memories where it's crystal clear little snapshot that doesn't have any context. You know, so yeah. Those are my memories of childhood as the astronaut's son. And so we get these stories, we get Bill and Frank together, and, you know, Ed Shipley was really good at asking the questions that would get the two of them chatting about stuff. And we'd have these really fun experiences. And so, yes, I did hear about it a lot, but it was generally towards the tail end of his interest in at the time where he was actually interested in talking about it. So it's cut back quite a bit. He said when he took the 50th, when we crossed the threshold of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 18, Apollo 8 in 2018, he said, "I'm retiring as the table decoration and astronaut." So we've walked away from a lot of events and conversations. He's done a few, but he's really cut back on it.
After his time, I guess, with the Air Force, with NASA, he ended up with General Dynamics.
Yeah, so he went from NASA into government and had a very successful career there, where he was a commissioner at the Atomic Energy Commission. He was the first chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and then he was ambassador to Norway. Well, the first job he did was secretary of the National Aeronautics and Space Council. So Deke Slayton pushed him up into NASA, into D.C., to try to run cover for the whole space program. Bill knew that he would probably never get command of a mission, and he also knew that he would be promoted up one step from lunar module pilot to command module pilot. So he knew that he was backup crew for Apollo 11. He was Buzz Aldrin's backup crew, so he was lunar module pilot backup for 11. And he was going to be prime crew for Apollo 13, but between 11 and 13, he would have promoted to command module pilot. And he's like, "Well, I don't want to go up and circle the moon again. I do have 5 kids. So, you know, this is not exactly risk-free business." So
right.
I think he kind of second thought that through. And he took the job up in D.C. So National Aeronautics Space Council, Nuclear or Atomic Energy Commission, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Ambassador to Norway. He came back from Jimmy Carter got elected, and ambassadorships tend to be political animals. And so he came back and he said, I'm going to retire from military, get back into the reserves. He couldn't have a military government commission and a military commission. So he got back into the reserves and started working in the civilian world. Worked under Jack Welch at General Electric. So he's one of the Jack Welch lead managers that ended up being a CEO.
Okay.
Went from General Electric over to Textron, was in charge of Bell Helicopters, Cherry Ball Bearings, and a couple other of the conglomerate that was to Textron at the time. Worked up to vice president there. And then had an opportunity to take the helm at General Dynamics. And so he did. And he came to General Dynamics during challenging time for the whole defense industry, and he brought into that industry a term called rationalization, and what it was we had all these defense industrial companies all spread out doing all of their different things and kind of wasting a lot of money by being everything. He basically said, we're either going to be number one or number two in our sector of the defense industry, or we're going to either perform acquisitions to become number one or two, or sell to get out of that industry. So he sold off quite a few of the different pieces, kept Electric Boat, kept the tank manufacturing, and several others. Was planning to keep the F-16 production. So he went to Dan Telep at Lockheed, made this huge sales pitch to Dan Telep about how Dan, for the good of the country, should sell Lockheed to General Dynamics. And as he was walking out the door, Telep kind of just said, well, Anders, your arguments are good. Would you consider selling? And so his perspective on serving the country properly by following this rationalization and cutting costs and stuff. So he sold the Viper production to Lockheed. So that's where the whole concept of General Dynamics converted, the Viper converted from a General Dynamics product to a Lockheed project.
Interesting.
Yeah. he was very much working against the flow. At the time it was, we'll try to buy anything we can to just make ourselves bigger, whether it's focused or not. That's who General Dynamics had been prior to his position. And fundamentally, he took the stock, he rationalized that the stock value represented the value of the company, which it did. And he moved the stock from a sub $20 a share position on this sort of sprawling, giant, complex military industrial company. And he took that stock up, if you look through that time frame as his leadership, up to about 120 something a share, just in a very short period, and that's when he was CEO and chairman of the board. So very transformational within the whole defense industry for him, his impact was very transformational for the whole defense industry.
Yeah, and obviously just a slight bump there. Did he ever talk about, because you mentioned the promotion inside with the command module, the lunar module, something I never thought about. How that process worked, was it, I assume there's some interagency politics that went on. I mean, what was
it? Yeah, I mean, it was really Deke Slayton, because of the bone spur in his back kind of came off of the flying status. So he was brought in to essentially take the position of being the chief pilot.
Okay.
Got those issues resolved and got to fly later. But it was Deke Slayton was really the guy that kind of managed everything. And my dad and Deke got along very well. But Bill was part of third group. Both Borman and Lovell were second group. And then, you know, we kind of all know the names of the first group guys. So Frank was a fairly aggressive promotion into a command position. But he'd done Gemini 7 and 14, I think it was, and done very well. And he and Jim had been paired together through that. And so Frank was clearly the command module pilot for the crew of Apollo 8. Which actually started out as the crew for Apollo 9, but that's an even more detailed, crazy story. and Bill was the lunar module pilot. So Bill was out there with Neil Armstrong flying that lunar landing training vehicle all the time, that spider thing that was crazy looking.
Yeah.
And that's one of my snippets of memory from childhood. It was that my mom took the five of us, but I have five siblings, but one of my siblings, my sister Diana, was born in 1972 after Bill flew the mission. So my four siblings was a group of five kids that were during the space program. And so I remember my mom driving us out to NASA in our, you know, wood-sided station wagon. I was me and my little brother sitting in the front seat, you know, because that's what we did in 1968. Everybody out in the back. And so we drive out and we walk out to the flight line and we watch my dad fly this lunar landing training vehicle. And I think it was either later that afternoon or the next day when Neil Armstrong was flying it and one of the rockets locked up, one of the positioning rockets locked up and tipped it over and he had to bail out. So you can go the YouTube video on of Neil Armstrong ejecting out of that thing. My dad was basically the guy that flew it before him. So imagine the courage it took from my mom. And I think the wisdom for her, for us to imprint on us this moment of memory, watching my dad fly this crazy vehicle. So it was pretty interesting.
That's why, you know, when you mentioned like, I got five kids, it's kind of risky. You know, you're thinking about while there were computers, the computer in our pocket with an iPhone or an Android, more computing power than any of the stuff to put together that technology, which is just wild.
The computing power then was just ridiculously absurd, and they still got it done. You know, and it's a reliance of understanding of physics, managed to make all those things work. So
science.
Yeah, math with the original computer, which we called one, were the humans, and two then became the slide rule. I bought a slide rule off of eBay to show to my staff here at the Heritage Flight Museum, and I brought it into my curator's office. I go, anybody know what this is? And everybody's looking at me like going, more weird shit from Greg.
Boss is out of control.
So, yeah.
I think so, on the same level of going to outer space would be popcorn, because that is quite the science that goes into it. Talk to me a little bit about the impetus of Firecorn and how it got started. Let's dig into this.
There's actually, we touched on one part of the topic earlier. When I did my radiation in 2012, I needed to do something. I was sitting, I had a friend of mine loan me a condo down in Seattle because I was doing the radiation in Seattle. And, you know, I could drive down there and drive back every day with a lot of commuting. But, you know, you get to the end of a radiation session, you don't know if you're going to be happy and healthy or if you're going to be feeling like crap. So a very good friend of our family said, hey, I've got a condo right downtown. And so I'd go down to her condo. I'd go down to my treatment Monday morning. From the treatment, I'd go to the condo. And I'd stay in the condo till like Wednesday. And I'd drive home Wednesday, say hi to Judy and the kids, and then go back down Thursday and Friday. So while I'm sitting in this condo, I'm not flying. I don't really have much to do. I've kind of disengaged from the museum significantly just because I needed to focus. I needed something to do, frankly, so I wrote a business plan to take Firecorn to market. And I was working with a friend of mine who lived in Seattle. She was running she was also trying to bring a snack product to the market. She had an industrial kitchen, so brought her on as kind of a consultant, and we managed to figure out how to build it, make it in an industrial kitchen, make it in the big Creeders things that are bigger than what we do at the squadron, and came up with the business plan in January. This is January, February, March was doing the radiation. And by the end of, within 3 months, I went from idea, I had the idea kind of before I started radiation, but within 3 months, I managed to figure out packaging, production, and we partnered with a company called Pop Gourmet, who helped us out quite a bit, got us to market in a package. We got to market, and you had to be in the market to go to this thing called the Sweets and Snacks Show. So the end of March, we go to the Sweets and Snacks Show. We all wear fighter pilot flight suits. We got Firecorn stitched on the back. and we're all walking in like we're a bunch of fighters. It was awesome. And we won most innovative new product because we figured out how to make, and the fire corn I make is somewhat different than what's made in the squadron. We have to cook it a little differently just because we got to make sure all the moisture is out of the jalapenos by the time it goes in the bag, because of otherwise it'll mold.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different, but I think we have been very successful at finding that sweet spot between totally charred jalapenos and a well crisped jalapeno.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm like the crispy jalapeno. The worst ones you get, man, someone gets like the soggy jalapenos in there. It's like, this is no good. But there are.
Yeah. If you get that in the squadron, you can handle it. But in the bag, it would be it within about 3 months, it would be both soggy and moldy. So that would be really good. So it's not as simple as we thought, but we worked it out. So I ran the company for 10 years with Pop Gourmet as my exclusive manufacturing distribution partner. They had some issues in terms of management and growth and all that kind of stuff, and ended up declaring bankruptcy, and I got liberated from them and their issue and the issues. I've sold over about $2.5 million worth of popcorn. And really, because of the way the Pop Gourmet was being managed, I never really made any money at it. So I'm still deeply in the red. So I almost turned the whole thing off when they went into, it ain't easy and it ain't cheap.
Yeah.
I almost turned the switch off when they went into bankruptcy, but then I decided, let's give it one more shot. And I stumbled on this thing called, you and I've talked about it, the for sale by Amazon, which is a direct to consumer sales model. And so Amazon allows me to build a store, and I can sell my popcorn through Amazon. It's not cheap, and I do not like the price I have on my product right now. I'm trying to work to bring it down, but it's available, and that is huge. So we've sold about $23,000 worth of popcorn in the first couple of weeks of production. We're not selling enough to make it a viable business, but you know, I need to get the word out. We've built the wheel. Now we have to attach the wheel to the drivetrain, kind of thing. So now it's a step-by-step process. And I'm really proud of what we've done with it. We're building into a successful business model. And my real goal for this is not so much that Firecorn is just strictly a successful product on the market. The brand has been super successful. I sold $12,000 worth of popcorn day one of being on Amazon because my Facebook followers were like, I'm buying some. And so it was awesome. And they're still buying and it's great, even though I think I'm charging too much and I'm trying to fix that, but that's the reality. My real goal with Firecorn is to build a financial vehicle, a little financial engine that can run a storytelling vehicle. And the storytelling is about the fighter pilot. So Heritage Flight, our firecornpopcorn.com, it's the tip of the iceberg of how I want to run that story. It took me many years to consolidate. We have fighter pilots. We've got a great story. We'll shoot our watch anytime. You know, it's awesome. You get us started, and you can't stop us. But how to tell that story to the general public in a consistent fashion that makes sense and is concise enough for people to understand what the main point is. And so it took me years, and I finally boiled it down to one liner. I perform so we win. That's why you work so hard as a Viper driver to be the best you can. You're going to go out and you're going to dogfight with your wingman and you're going to kick their ass, you know, and you're going to do that Iceman and Maverick thing of, oh, you know, you suck, buddy, you know, and that kind of thing. But you're really, it's I perform so that we win. It comes down to what the team is, who the team is, and how to be the best you can as an individual, so that the organization you are supporting wins. And I think that story kind of goes across, whether you're a software developer, whether you're a machinist at a manufacturing company, any of that. So I think that story, I think that's one of the reasons that Top Gun works so well, is because it does really capture all of those elements in that way. And it's a well-done movie. I think both of them. I mean, Top Gun, the first one came out when I was in pilot training. So we all wanted to be, you know, fighter pilots and go out and buy motorcycles and all kinds of shit. And I think both versions of the franchise have been very successful at telling the story effectively. There's been an awful lot of fighter pilot movies that are just plain trash and I can't even watch because it's so fake, so off. That's why Masters of the Air, like we were talking, thinking about earlier, so well done. Yes, there are some issues, but you know, we don't need to go down those tiny rabbit holes there, because they're tiny rabbit holes. It's really well done productions that tell a story very effectively. That's what I'm hoping Firecorn will be a storytelling vehicle run by this little motor in the middle of the retail sales of Firecorn popcorn. Beer's favorite snack.
I love it. I mean, I just think about it. I mean, jalapeno popcorn, Firecorn. How much does that fuel? That fuels the debrief. That fuels the story. That fuels the learning. I mean, that's and, just think and about how many stories that's heard.
And I still love it. I missed it, you know, because I, you know, my wife is like, oh, you're not cooking jalapeno popcorn in my kitchen. So, and I still love it. We've developed a second flavor. We have the original, which is, you know, just plain jalapeno popcorn, which tends to sell better to the fighter pilot community. So when it was when the Pentagon orders were coming in, as we talked about a little earlier, those tended to be the original recipe. We developed a white cheddar flavor, which is outside of anything we've done in the fighter squadron bars. This came from a fellow named Sachin that was at Pop Gourmet. Really talented palate, very talented brain and very imaginative. And we developed a white cheddar fire corn, and it sells in a stabilized market. It sells 2-1.
Really?
On a consumer basis. It's unreal. And it tends to, you know, but for you, it tends to be, I want the original. And for me, it's still my favorite, although I do love, you know, here's our bags. We call them sharing bags.
Okay.
But very rarely do I put one down that isn't, you know, just down to the crumbs. So it's kind of a sharing bag. But it's really fighter pilot individual serving. In fact, I might put that line in there. It's a fighter pilot individual serving.
I don't understand the sharing concept you just mentioned. So
it's about four solo cups, right? You know, that's what we'd walk around the bar with beer in one solo cup and fire corn in the other.
Like in any other setting, like I might have a bowl of popcorn at home to watch a movie with the wife, right? And you share that. In the fighter squadron, I would have a bowl of popcorn in front of me.
Exactly. I'm going to the debrief. This is mine. You go get your own. You forgot to get some. Sucks being you.
Yeah. Got to make another batch.
Exactly. Lieutenants.
All right. So right now, those looking for Firecorn, they can find it on Amazon. That's the easiest. And obviously, do a website.
That is the only source right now. I'm hoping to grow outside of it, but I got, you know, you can only build so many things at once. I'm hoping to grow outside of that, and the Amazon is a very effective, albeit expensive, vehicle for doing that. So I don't like the price on there right now, but it's just what it is. I'm not doing big margins on it, but I'm doing enough to do some marketing right now and trying to build the brand presence and trying to streamline. So I'm going to change the box size. One of the fees on Amazon is just strictly based on the volume of the box. So I'm changing the box size to kind of shrink the box so that they fit the bags better. This is the current box. It's very cool. I love it, but it's the wrong shape, and there's a lot of space in there, and it doesn't stack in well. So that's the kind of learning thing that I'm going through right now. So I'm redesigning the box so they fit in 6 bags perfectly, and I can reduce my cost at Amazon slightly by that. So I love that's it. What we're We're optimizing production costs, but I'm also rushing to market so you guys can have it.
Yeah, people need it. People need the corn. Again, every time we talk about on the podcast, people are asking. Now this is their chance. And they don't have to go fumigate their entire household attempting to do it on their stove or their little mini maker. Because that's the thing too. Like once you cook fire corn, jalapeno popcorn in the corn machine, like that's now what it is. It is going to be a baked in flavor. So if you're borrowing your neighbor's machine.
That's what we had. Very few fire popcorn companies are like, they're like, you want us to cook your jalapenos in my popcorn popper. And I'm supposed to follow that with a caramel popcorn.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
I do. That's what I want.
So it took us a while to find somebody that was willing to do it.
That's awesome. I can only imagine. Well, BA, I appreciate you hanging around and just sharing a little about your story. If you have a few more minutes, I think you said you're going to hang around for a There I Was story. But before we part ways, a 15, 16 year old BA walking down the street, you bump into him. Is there any life advice you would give him? Tips, tricks, things to tell him to do differently?
I remember when I was going into the Air Force Academy, you know, I looked at, you know, if you went to pilot training, it was a 10-year commitment. And this is what I do at the air shows. I talk this point at the air shows as well. And to me, as a 17, 18-year-old, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm committing 10 full years of my life. This is nuts. And it blew by so fast, and it was so much fun. So focus on what you want to do. Sometimes the prices of, you know, 10-year commitment, those kind of price tags, they're freaking nothing. I mean, I got to fly fighters. I got to fly B-52s, F-15Es, A-10s, led me to P-51s, P-47s, Spitfires, T-6s. Freaking imagine the Greg Anders that said 10 years is just too much. I'm not going to do it. That's what I would be telling myself is stop worrying about the little shit.
Love it.
Pursue your passions.
BA, thanks. It was great words to end on. And I look forward to talking to the I was here.
All right. Thank you, Rain.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.